Okay, so let's take a moment and cultivate our motivation. And since last week when we heard the teachings, we've had the great fortune to live another week. Our life could have so easily been interrupted, but it wasn't. So let's rejoice that we have this opportunity again to listen to teachings. But also be aware that death could come at any time, and therefore we don't have any time to waste, because our life is very meaningful, has a lot of purpose, because we can use it to create the causes to die well and have a good rebirth, create the causes for liberation and full enlightenment. And so let's really make a strong determination to do just that and to apply ourselves to learning, reflecting on, and meditating on the Buddha's teachings for the benefit of all sentient beings. Okay. So, we've been contemplating mind training like rays of the sun. And we're on page 19. If you don't have the book, don't worry about it because I'm reading it, so you can listen to it while I'm reading. So here we're starting the actual teachings, which begin with the first kind of phrase or slogan, which says, first train in the preliminaries. Okay. It doesn't say, first go to the highest, most complicated, exotic practice with the longest name and the best advertisement. That's not what it says. It says, first train in the preliminaries. Okay. So the first paragraph here, it says, this involves contemplating the significance and rarity of life as a free and fortunate human being. That's the first preliminary. Contemplating impermanence and death, which leads to the realization that our life can end at any time. That's the second preliminary. And thinking about the causes and results of actions, third preliminary. And the vicious nature of cyclic existence, fourth preliminary, okay? So precious human life, impermanence and death, the karma and its effects, and the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Those are sometimes called the four things that turn the mind to the Dharma. From these basic practices up to the training in the ultimate awakening mind, that means the realization, the wisdom realizing emptiness, the practice can be divided into two, the actual meditation session and the period between sessions. Okay, so practice includes everything, our formal meditation and the break times. And the actual session is divided into three, preparation, meditation, and dedication. Okay, so firstly, as the life story of Guru Dharmamati of Sumatra shows, Guru Dharmamati is Sirlingpa. Okay, so it's not Dhammarekshita who was the author of Wheel of Sharp Weapons. They're two different people. Okay, so according to his life story, we should decorate the place, arrange representations of the three jewels, the Buddha, the fully awakened being, his doctrine, and the spiritual community, offer a mandala representing the world system, and complete the six kinds of conduct up to the request that the three great purposes of self, others, and both shall be fulfilled. Okay? So this talks about the six preparatory practices. So I'll explain this right now. So first we sweep and clean the room. So I know some of you don't like that so much. So you got to put all your dirty teacups in the sink and clean them. You got to make your bed and, you know, things like this. But actually it has a very good effect on your mind if you keep your room very tidy and clean, because how you keep your environment reflects how you keep your mind. So you clean the environment, and also thinking, according to the thought training practice, that you're sweeping or vacuuming up the defilements of sentient beings. Okay, so that's the first of the six preliminaries. The second one is to, the other part of the first preliminary is to set up the altar. Okay, so when you have an altar, by the way, altar is spelled A-L-T-A-R. So many people write to me and say, how do I set up an altar, A-L-T-E-R, as an alter ego or an alternative? But it's A-L-T-A-R, okay, altar, or a shrine, okay? So how do you set one up? Usually in the highest place, we put a picture of our spiritual mentor, yeah? Because the spiritual mentor is the one that connects us to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then just below that, we have an image of the Buddha that represents the Buddha's form or the Buddha's body. On the Buddha's right, or on our left as we look at it, there is a text, and that represents the Buddha's speech. So it's good to have one of the Prajnaparamita texts if you can. And then on the Buddha's left, or our right as we look at the altar, is a representation of the Buddha's mind. And that could be a bell, or it could be a stupa. A stupa are those monuments that are made, that often the big ones people circumambulate. Here you just put a small one on your altar. Okay, and then you can have pictures of Tenrezi and Manjushri and any other deities that you practice all around there. Okay, and it's very neat and tidy. And I always have my altar higher. If it's in my bedroom, I put it higher than where my bed is. Yeah, because I don't want to be looking down at the Buddha when I sleep, okay? The Buddha should be higher than me. So similarly, you know, if you're seated on the floor, if you're, you know, have your altar in another room, if you're on the floor, the Buddha's higher up. If you're seated on a chair, then you raise the Buddha higher still, okay? Okay, so that's setting up the altar. Then the second one is to make offerings, okay? So here we can offer anything that we consider beautiful. And the purpose of offerings is to create joy and delight in being generous, in giving, and to free ourselves from miserliness, and to create a lot of merit, because the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are very powerful objects because of their spiritual realizations. And so we create very strong karma with them. So if we make offerings to them, it's quite potent karma. Okay, so there's a practice of offering seven water bowls. Yeah, if we do that, then we have seven bowls that are clean. We wipe out each one with a cloth and put it upside down. We never leave right side up empty bowls on the altar. So you would wipe it and put it upside down. Again, the cloth being the wisdom realizing emptiness, any dust in the inside of the bowl being the defilements of sentient beings. So you're cleansing sentient beings' minds with the wisdom realizing emptiness. So you wipe each bowl and put them one on top of each other, upside down. Okay, then you take them and you put them in your hand here, and you put some water in the top bowl. Okay, it doesn't need to be totally full, just some water. Then you pick up the top bowl and you pour all the water, but a little bit into the second bowl, and you put that one down, and you put it on the Buddha's right or on your left as you're facing the altar. Okay, then you pick up the next one and you pour everything out, you leave a little bit, and you put that one second, and you leave them about a rice grain's distance apart. I never understood whether it was long grain rice or short grain rice, so please excuse me. Then you take the third one and you pour all the water but a little bit and put that one down. And so you go like this until the end of the row. So it's very important to make the offering bowls all in a straight line and all just that short distance apart. You don't want them to be too close, because that's like being too close and getting burnt, you know, or being too distant, like being separated from your teacher. So just the right amount, yeah. And so each bowl has a little bit of water. Then, and you sing Om Ma Hung, because those three syllables consecrate it, you know, when you're putting it down. Then you go back to the first bowl, and you fill it up again within a rice grain's distance from the top. Yeah. So you don't make it completely full so that the water is slightly above and it's about ready to spill, because you want your offerings to be neat. This is very much a practice in taking care and being respectful. So you don't want to fill your bowl so full that there's water all over the place. And you don't want to leave them so empty as if you're being miserly and not offering very much. So you offer, you know, each one in turn, yeah, filling it up till almost the top, but not quite. And again, saying Om Ma Hung to consecrate it. And you imagine as you're filling it that you're offering the Buddha wisdom nectar. The water is like wisdom nectar. Or you can think while you're pouring it that you're filling the sentient beings up with this very blissful wisdom nectar. Okay. Then you can also offer candles, or maybe better yet is electric lights, because then there's no danger of fire. Yeah, and really don't take this lightly, because one Dharma center I lived in France, a whole wing of it burnt down because somebody left the candle on their altar burning and when they left the room. Yeah, so this is why at the Abbey we don't allow burning candles and lit incense in people's rooms. It's just too dangerous. Okay, so you can offer candles, incense, you can put some food up there. Yeah, you can put flowers. Flowers represents offering virtue, and it also represents impermanence, because the flowers are so beautiful and then they fade and, you know, you got to throw them out. So it's like our body. Yeah, when you're young, you're beautiful, and then, you know, body just gets decrepit. Yeah, you can offer light. That represents wisdom. It creates the karma to receive wisdom. Offer incense. That represents ethical conduct, because they say that people who keep very pure ethical conduct have a very fragrant smell around them. You can offer food. That represents samadhi, because people who have very deep samadhi are nourished by their meditative concentration. They don't need to eat as much. Yeah. You can offer music. Some of our pujas, we ring bells or play drums, and that represents, again, impermanence or emptiness. Okay. And so you make all these offerings, and you say Om Ma Hung with each one, you know, to consecrate it as your offering to the Buddha. At the end, and so you do this in the morning, so it's a very nice practice to do when you first get up. Even if you're half asleep, it's a very good habit of getting yourself into, because you're making offerings and thinking of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then at the end of the day, you can take the offerings down. So with the water, you start at the Buddha's left, or as we, on our right, and you take that one and empty it into a pitcher. And then if they're the kind of bowls that dry without spotting, then you don't need to wipe it you know, you can wipe it if you want to, but it's not necessary. So you pour the water out and then you turn it upside down, okay? And then you take the next one, pour it into the pitcher, turn it upside down, and you can stack the bowls, one leaning on the next, if you want to. And when you're taking the water down, then you can recite the Vajrasattva mantra and think that you are purifying sentient beings, you know, pouring away their afflictions and negative karma, and, you know, reciting Vajrasattva. And so you do this with all of the bowls. And then the leftover water, put in some flowers or some plants, or throw it outside where nobody walks. Don't flush it down the toilet or throw it down the drain so it mixes in with all the other dirty things. Try and put it in some clean place. The food, it doesn't say this in the scriptures, but I think it's very helpful to request the Buddha's permission to take the food. Otherwise, I've noticed so many people who offer food to the Buddha and they just happen to take it off the altar when it's their lunchtime or dessert time. Then I wonder if they really offered it. You know, they said Om Ahong, but did they really offer it? Or were they just putting it on the altar until they wanted it? Okay, so that's why I think it's good to ask the Buddha's permission as a caretaker for the Buddha's possessions, if we can take the food. And then we can either eat it ourselves or give it to friends, whatever. Okay, flowers, again, you throw outside someplace where they can decompose. Yeah? And you kind of, you know, put your altar to sleep in that way at the end of the day. So it's a very nice way to frame your day. And so offerings can really be quite nice, because when you're making each offering, don't just think, oh, I'm offering this small bowl of water to the Buddha, okay? But you think that it's transforming into so much blissful wisdom nectar, and that there's these beautiful offerings just filling the sky. You know, so you're not just offering one flower, but the whole sky is full of beautiful flowers. And you're not just offering one apple, but the whole sky is full of apples, organic ones, you know, so you don't want the Buddha to have to eat pesticides, you know. So you can imagine that things are very pure and, you know, the apples don't have pits and things like that. You imagine very nice things to offer. Okay, and when you're actually making the actual offerings, it's good to offer the best quality that we have. In other words, don't go to the grocery store, buy a whole bunch of fruit, and put the ones that got bruised on the altar and keep the good ones for yourself. Okay, it shouldn't be like that. We put the nice ones on the altar and then we eat the, you know, the ones that are going bad. Okay, so, and it's a very, very, I don't know, the mind feels so happy when we can make very beautiful offerings. Yeah, there's something so wonderful about visualizing beauty, and especially things that you think are just gorgeous. Visualize the whole sky full of them and offer them. Okay, it's very nice, really makes the mind quite happy. Yeah, and if you're attached to something, yeah, when you're making offerings, imagine millions of those. You know, so I don't know how many zillions of computers the Buddha gets, you know. So all these people who want to upgrade, you know, all the people who like all the widgets, the technological widgets, and they're always looking through the magazine, oh, what's the latest thing that's come out? And then, okay, I've got to restrain my attachment. I really don't need this. Yeah, so it's a practice to cut off your attachment to it. Then you offer beautiful, you know, iPods and stupendous computers and fantastic color printers that actually work, you know. And all sorts of beautiful things, the sky full of them to the Buddha. Okay, you imagine the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas accept them with much pleasure. Okay, so that's the meaning of actual offerings. So the ones that you put on the offering, on the altar, and mentally transformed ones are the ones that you imagine. Okay, then the third of the six preparatory practices is to sit in a comfortable position and examine your mind. Yeah, so you stop and you go, okay, is my mind peaceful? Or is my mind in a hurry and flurry? Or is my mind falling asleep? What's going on? Okay, so if your mind is kind of distracted, you're still thinking of the day's activities, yeah, then do some breathing meditation. And, you know, maybe just 21 breaths, some short meditation like that. And you know, let your mind calm down. Some people like to do longer breathing meditation. I was suggesting 21 if you're going on to do some of the Lam Rim analytic meditations. But, you know, if you need more time to do more breathing meditation to stabilize your mind, please take that time and do that, okay? Because you want your mind to be calm and kind of peaceful before you start the analytic meditations, okay? And then also as part of the third step, then you generate a good motivation. Yeah? And so you really reflect on, well, why am I meditating, okay? And sometimes when you sit there and you go, well, why am I meditating? It's just like, well, this is what I do at 5:30 every morning. That's the only motivation you have. Or, you know, everybody else in the community is doing it. I just got up with them, you know. So you just stop and, you know, see what your real motivation is. And then cultivate, you know, the aspiration for full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Okay? Now, when it says sit in a comfortable position as part of the third one, this refers to the sevenfold position of Vairochana. It's eightfold if you include the breathing meditation, but I already covered that. And so there, the recommended position is if you can sit in the full Vajra position, which means that your right foot is on your left thigh and then your left foot is on your right thigh. Some people call that the lotus, but it's actually called the Vajra position. Then if you can sit like that, great. If you can't, then try the half Vajra with one leg down and the other one up. If that doesn't work so well, then sit like Tara sits, with your left leg tucked in and your right leg in front, you know, and both your legs flat on the floor. If that doesn't work, sit cross-legged, okay? If that doesn't work, then try a meditation bench. You know, those small benches and the back is tilted. So you tuck your legs under the bench and then you sit on the little bench. Okay, if that doesn't work, then sit in a chair. Okay, when you sit in a chair, sit in a straight back chair with your feet flat on the floor. Don't sit in a nice, comfortable lounge. You know, because you know what happens if you do that. Okay? Okay, so you're seated, then keep your back straight because that helps the circulation of the subtle airs or winds in your body. Then your hands are either right on the left, like this, your thumbs touching to form a triangle. So your thumbs aren't slouching like that, okay? They're up like this, and that's right in your lap, you know? So it's your hands are in your lap, touching your body, yeah, right at the level of your stomach. So your abdomen, your stomach's up here, your abdomen's lower, okay. And then your hands just rest naturally, and when they do, then there's a little space between your body and your arms. So when your hands are in your lap, don't make yourself so tight that your hands are like, arms become like chicken wings. They're stuck out. Yeah. Okay. And don't make them so flat like you're sitting here like this. Okay. But just in a normal way. And then your shoulders level. Yeah. What I found can be very helpful is if you have pain in your back, then lift your shoulders real high like this. Tuck your neck in. Okay. And then drop your shoulders really hard and then just kind of wiggle your neck a little bit. And so I find that very helpful if there's tension in the shoulders. So high tuck your neck. Lift them really high, you know. I mean, as high as you can get them. And then let them go. And then just kind of, again, tuck your neck in and just, yeah. So I find that very helpful if you have tension back here. Okay? Then your face is level. Or if anything, just slightly, the chin is tucked in. Okay? If your chin gets too low, that's what happens. Okay? Or if you raise your chin higher, you know, some people who have bifocals, I've noticed, you know, you look at them, they're always looking at you like this. And it took me a long time to realize they're not looking down on me. They're just trying to focus, you know. But, yeah, but, you know, you don't want your head to be like this because then your neck's going to get sore. So you just want your, you know, level like this. And then your mouth is closed and you breathe through your nose unless you have allergies or a cold. And then breathe any way you can. Okay? I say this being somebody who frequently gets colds and has allergies, you know. I remember so many retreats teaching breathing meditation and I can't breathe. Yeah. So then if you can't breathe through your nose, just breathe through your mouth. Just breathe, okay? And okay, so presuming you can do it through your nose, then keep your mouth shut. They say to put your tongue on the tip of your, yeah, on your palate. I'm not sure where else your tongue would go. I don't know. When I close my mouth, my tongue's on my palate. Do you have any place else your tongue can go? Do you have a space between your tongue and the palate?
People have funny habits sometimes.
People have funny habits?
Their tongue
about it. Oh, yeah, okay. So maybe people have funny habits. Yeah. Okay. So just try and, you know, keep your mouth closed. You know, your tongue inside and there. Then your eyes are lowered, but they're not really looking at anything. They say to rest them on the tip of your nose. I have a big nose, so that's fairly easy. But it doesn't always feel comfortable, so I think kind of just down in front of you is quite fine. Yeah, that lets some light in. That way you don't get sleepy or tired. Yeah, if you really have problems getting sleepy or tired, take a little bowl of water, not a big cup, but a little bowl, and you balance it on your head when you meditate. And it usually only takes falling asleep once when you're in a room full of people and the bowl falls. And usually after that, then you don't fall asleep so much. There's certain positive attributes to being embarrassed. Okay. If you're a monastic and you have a dingwa, a seating cloth, I think it's very helpful when we sit down to think, you know, because our dingwa is just has four corners and it's right over our seat. Then we think, my attention is not going beyond the scope of this dingwa. In other words, it's not going, you know, to the computer. It's not going to fixing breakfast. It's not going to what I did 20 years ago or what I have to do tomorrow. It's staying right here within, you know, these four corners of my seating cloth. Okay, so I find that very helpful. So you're sitting there, you're not looking at what your neighbor's doing, you're not, you know, if you're in a room full of people, you're not thinking about, gee, that person's moving, making too much noise with their mala, or gee, why are they breathing so loud, or how come they're unzipping, how come they're taking off their Velcro jacket in the middle of silent meditation. You know, you just have your attention right there on yourself and what's happening with you. Okay, so that's the third preparatory. The fourth one says visualize the merit field with the gurus, Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas. Okay, and then we take refuge. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Taking refuge came in the third step. Let's go back to the third step. Rewind. So part of the third step, sit quietly, comfortably, do the breathing meditation, set your motivation, and then take refuge and generate bodhicitta. Okay? So when we take refuge, we usually have the refuge visualization. So it's quite detailed. There's one big throne with five smaller thrones on it, and the Buddha sits in the front throne. Your actual teachers sit on the throne in front of the Buddha. The one on the Buddha's right, there's where Maitreya and the other lamas from the extensive lineage sit. The throne on the Buddha's left, that's where Manjushri and the other lineage lamas from the profound lineage sit. In the back, you have other of your spirit, you know, other spiritual mentors, Shantideva and those of the ear whispered lineage and so on. And then around, still on the big throne, but around the five smaller thrones, then you have a circle, you have the meditational deities, you have the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the solitary realizers, the hearers, the Dakas, Dakinis, the Dharma protectors. These are the Arya Dharma protectors, not mundane Dharma protectors. Okay? And so they're all on this one throne. So this is the refuge visualization. This is not to be confused with the field of merit. You have the same figures, but in the merit field, the merit field is in step four. The merit field, they're seated on the top of a tree that's in an ocean with a lotus on top, and then they're all seated on the petals of the lotus, and then some of the lamas are seated in the space, and Jason Kapa is the center figure there. So that's the one we have in our meditation hall, the field of merit. But here, this is the refuge visualization. If the refuge visualization with the big throne and the five smaller thrones, if that's too complicated for you, yeah? And by the way, don't expect yourself to see every single Buddha. It's like, you know, when you go into a room, you don't notice every single person. You get the general feeling that there's a lot of people in here, okay? So just have the feeling that you're in the presence of all of these. And, you know, you can focus in on different ones from time to time. Okay, I mean, it's good to make your visualization as clear as you can, but don't get discouraged if you can't, if everybody's not appearing, you know, completely clearly all at once. Yeah. So so they're seated around there. If it's that's too complicated, then just visualize the Buddha seated. He has a throne and then a lotus and then a moon and sun disc. And the Buddha seated on top of that. And then think of the Buddha as the embodiment of all the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so that can be easier. And again, you know, at the beginning, if you, you know, your eyes are lowered and, you know, you're generating a mental image of the Buddha. Yeah, so don't expect to see the Buddha with your eyes or something like that when you're visualizing. I remember one time in Mexico, I went to a Montessori school with these little kids to give them like a little Dharma talk and introduce them to Buddhist things. So we were going to sit down to meditate. We asked any of the kids if they knew how to meditate. And one little girl raises her hand and said, "I do." Then she sits and she goes, "Yeah?" So I watch, and sometimes adults do that too. You sit to sit to meditate. You know, you're not very relaxed, or, you know, kind of that your face, maybe your mouth isn't clenched, but somehow you're narrowing your focusing, like, so your brows knit somehow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, really check if you have the habit of doing that. I won't mention who does here. You know, then just really try and you know, be aware of relaxing your facial muscles. Okay. Yeah. So you're not squeezing to see the Buddha. Yeah, you're just like letting the image of the Buddha appear to you. Yeah, if you have a hard time visualizing the Buddha, then spend more time during the day looking at your altar and looking at the Buddha, you know, because it's the same mechanism. If I say, think of your best friend, then, you know, an image comes to your mind very easily. I say, think of your mother, the image comes to your mind very easily, even if you haven't seen your mother in a long time, you know, or even if she's passed away. But that all happens because of familiarity. So same thing, if we, you know, start looking at the Buddha images around us, you know, around our home, and we sit down to meditate, you know, we can visualize the Buddha easily. Okay, so you visualize the Buddha in front, or that you can do the more elaborate visualization, and then you think that your mother's on your left, your father's on your right, doesn't matter whether they're living or not. All the people that you don't like are right there in front of you, between you and the refuge field, okay? And they're looking at the refuge field, so they're not looking towards you, giving you a dirty look, but they're looking towards the Buddha. But you got to look at them to see the Buddha. You can't escape. And then all around you are all the other sentient beings. Okay. And then we think that we are leading all of the sentient beings in taking refuge, okay, and in generating bodhicitta. And so at that point, we can either stop and do a little meditation on refuge and on bodhicitta, and then say the prayer, you know, I take refuge until I am enlightened, that prayer that we always do. So you either do it like that, or you immediately call up that feeling of refuge and think of, you know, the good qualities of the Buddha and say the prayer, and you imagine that everybody else is saying it and taking refuge and generating bodhicitta together with you. And then you also do the four immeasurables at that point. And she can do the long version of the four immeasurables or the short version. Yeah, it's nice. Some days you just do everything very quickly. Some days you stop and just contemplate each of the four, you know, in a very strong way. Yeah. So the nice thing, something that I find quite nice about the way we do our practices in the Tibetan tradition is that there's no fixed speed to how fast or slow or what melody you use when you do the different recitations. You can say them very fast, which sometimes is good because it makes your mind concentrate. You can say them very slow, which gives you more time to think about them while you're saying them. You can say them and then pause and really meditate on each thing. Okay? So, you know, you can change it from day to day as you do your practice. Don't think that every day has to be the same. Okay? Be a little bit creative here, you know? Okay. So that, now maybe we're done with the third step, okay? Actually, after you do that, then the refuge visualization, does, you know, all the figures in the refuge field dissolve into the Buddha, and the Buddha comes on top of your head and dissolves into you and goes into your heart. Okay? Then step four, okay, is to visualize the merit field with the gurus, Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas. Yeah, and so that's the tree that I described that we have the tanka of. And I think, do we have a photograph of the tanka on our website or on tuptonchodron.org? Yeah, we photographed it. I think there must be somewhere on one of the websites. Okay, but you have the ocean and then the trees coming out of it, and at the top of the tree there's a lotus where the layers of the petals go down over the side of the tree. And then you have Jesongkhapa in the center, and then, you know, Manjushri on his left in the sky in the lineage of the profound, Maitreya on his right with the lineage of the extended, and so on, all the different figures around like that. Okay? Again, if that's too complicated, yeah, then you just think of the Buddha in the space in front. If you want to, and think of the Buddha as the embodiment of all the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. If you want to make it a guru yoga practice, when you visualize the Buddha, or in this case you would visualize Lama Tsongkhapa and the Buddha at his heart and Vajradhara at the Buddha's heart, then you can think that your spiritual mentor and the Buddha are the same nature. Okay? And actually all of your spiritual mentors and the Buddha are the same nature. So you can think of it as your spiritual mentor appearing in the form of the Buddha or in the form of Jay Rinpoche. You know, like that. Yeah. And it's important when you do this, when you're trying to make it a guru yoga practice, that you're not thinking of the personality of your teacher. Yeah? Because I think this is a big mistake we often make, is we like the personality of our teacher, but then when our teacher dies, then we feel lost because that personality isn't there anymore. But actually, we should be trying to look beyond the superficial personality of our teacher and really think, you know, what is their mind? You know? And since this is a practice where we're seeing them as the same nature of the Buddha, then it becomes a practice of reflecting on what is the Buddha's mind like? Okay? And then seeing those two as separate. The purpose of doing that is then when we listen to teachings, we listen to the teachings better. Yeah? Because if we listen to teachings and we think, oh, here's my spiritual mentor who is, you know, the same nature as the Buddha teaching me, then we think, oh, they're telling me the same thing the Buddha would tell me, you know. So then we listen closely if we think, oh, yeah, you know, here's somebody who's like, you know, the Buddha who's telling me. Okay. Whereas if we think of our spiritual mentor as just kind of Joe Blow who doesn't know much and, you know, picks their nose and burps and, you know, all these, you know, make mistakes and, you know, contradicts themselves and whatever. You know, they tell you to put milk in their tea and then they tell you don't put milk in their tea and, you know, or they change their mind a lot or they change the schedule a lot or, you know, they talk when it's silent time. So if you get really into picking at the faults of your teacher, then you'll never find any end to the faults, okay? Yeah, because the mind is very creative and will think of many, many faults. But that isn't very beneficial for us, okay? We're trying to look beyond that and to think, you know, because if we look at our teachers just, you know, here's this person who's just like, yeah, you know, then when they teach, we're going to go, well, you know, can I really trust what they're saying? You know, and do they really mean this? And do they really care about me? And do they know what they're talking about? And all this doubt comes in our mind. And that kind of doubt is not very helpful, you know. So it's not that we want to listen to our teacher and just go, hallelujah, I believe. No, that's not it either. You know, we should have a critical mind and be intelligent and think about the teachings and examine them and contemplate them, okay? But if we have you know, if we're seeing our teacher as the representative of the Buddha, the emanation of the Buddha, or something like that, then we listen more closely. Yeah? And then we think, oh, these teachings are for me. Because lots of times we sit in a teaching and there's, you know, like you go to His Holiness Dalai Lama's teachings, there's what, 5,000 people, sometimes 500,000 people. You know, I mean, in India, just huge numbers of people. And then you think, oh, well, he's just teaching this. You know, it's not for me. Yeah? So His Holiness talks about being patient and kind. And you think, oh, yeah, he's talking to all those other people in the audience. But, there's, you know, he's not talking to me. So we shouldn't think like this, you know. When we're in teachings, whether it's a, you know, we're the only person, or there's 5 million and three people. The teachings we should think are being directed towards us personally, because they are. There's something for us to practice. Okay, so seeing, you know, the teacher and the Buddha as one nature helps us to do that, to really take things seriously, and to feel like we have a, you know, a personal connection there when we're doing the meditation and also when we're listening to teachings. Yeah. Because sometimes, I mean, it's always best, especially at the beginning of our practice, to live close to our teacher and to see our teacher regularly. After some time, that may not be possible. I mean, I don't see my teachers very often. So this practice of guru yoga becomes quite important, because then every morning when I'm visualizing you know, the various deities or the Buddha or whatever. I think, you know, here's my teachers appearing in this form, and it's all my teachers, you know. So it's not like it's one conglomerate personality. So I'm not thinking of their personalities. I'm thinking of their qualities, their wisdom and compassion and so forth. And okay, they're all here, and I can communicate with them in that way. Yeah. And so that way you don't feel so separate and far away from your teachers. And especially if your teacher has passed away, you know, okay, that physical body's not there. But, you know, that same nature, that is the nature of the Buddha, is still present. And so we still think of our spiritual mentor in that way. And we still feel close to them even if they've passed away. Yeah. And so that kind of meditation I find very helpful, you know, because otherwise if I'm far away from my teachers and, you know, everything's crazy around me, then if I think I'm all alone, you know, in this boat of samsara, in this ocean of samsara, you know, hell, then it's quite desperate, you know. But if I think, okay, close your eyes and you visualize the Buddha or Jay Rinpoche and they're the same nature as my teacher, then, you know, you feel like you have some support and understanding, and you think of their qualities, and, you know, a very close feeling comes. So it's really quite helpful, you know. I strongly recommend doing that. And then also, when you have a problem, it can be really helpful, because then, you know, you just, and this comes after you've heard a lot of teachings after a period of years, you know, then you just close your eyes and visualize, you know, the Buddha, whichever deity it is, and think of them as the nature of your teacher. And then you kind of voice your problem. And then you've heard enough teachings at that time, and the answer comes, you know. You just know which of the teachings you've heard from your teacher that is applicable to this problem that you have right now. Okay. So that's a very good way to, you know, get help when you need it. You know, you're doing your own internal 911 to the Buddha. Yeah. And then you don't need to get so frustrated when you're just constantly trying to call your teacher and you can't get through, or you get their attendant and the attendant doesn't put you through and everything like this. Yeah. So you have your own direct line. Yeah. Don't have to go through any attendants. Yeah. Okay. I got off on a tangent there. Okay, so here you are, step number four, you're visualizing the merit field. Okay, and then you, you know, it's the merit field or the single Buddha or Jay Rinpoche with the Buddha at his heart, Vajradhara at his heart. Okay, and then step five of the preparatory practices, okay, is to do the seven limb prayer. Yeah, and so what I'm describing actually, if those of you who have the Pearl of Wisdom, the blue book, these are the prayers that are all listed in there. Okay, and I can't remember. Do you remember what page?
Page 37 or so. The abbreviated.
The abbreviated recitations, page 37. Yeah. So this is what it is. So you offer the seven limb prayer. Okay, so. We've covered a lot of things. The four preliminaries, we're doing the six the six preparatory practices, now the seven, the four immeasurables, the seven limb prayer. You know, if you like lists, be a Buddhist. Okay, so the seven limb prayer. The first one is prostration. So this is to generate respect and humility. Okay, purify arrogance, create merit. So we either physically bow or we put our hands together like this. And again, we imagine all the sentient beings bowing together with us. Then the next one is offering. And here we imagine, again, the sky full of beautiful clouds of offering. Yeah, and offer that. The third of the seven limb prayer is confession, and here we recall all of our negative actions without trying to justify or deny or conceal or rationalize any of them. We just put them out there with a sense of regret and a determination not to do them again. The fourth of the seven limbs is to rejoice. So we not only confess, but we also rejoice at our own and others' virtue and merit. And then the fifth and sixth ones, sometimes they come in one order, sometimes they come in the other order. Sometimes it's first requesting your teachers to give teachings, and then requesting the Buddhas to remain until samsara ends. Once in a while, it's in the opposite order, and you're requesting the Buddhas and your teachers to stay until samsara ends, and then next request them for teachings. So those are the fifth and sixth. And then the seventh one's dedication. Okay, and so you're dedicating all the merits for the benefit, the enlightenment of yourself and others. Okay, so you offer the seven-limb prayer. And then, actually, if you do the King of Prayers, the prayers of the extraordinary aspirations of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra, King of Prayers, that's in the red book, page
55.
Okay. So if you look, the first two pages there are an extended version of the seven-limb prayer. There's several versions of prostration and homage, several versions of offering, verses of offering, and then one verse either from confession, rejoicing, requesting them to turn the Dharma real, requesting them to remain in samsara, and dedication. So that's a longer version of the seven-limb prayer. Okay? And then you offer the mandala. So here, mandala means our universe and everything that's beautiful in our universe. So according to the ancient Indian vision of the universe, it's flat with a center mountain and four continents and eight subcontinents. And then the sun and the moon and all these beautiful things. And so if you do the long mandala, it lists out sometimes 25 things, sometimes 37 things, I think it is. You know, so you can, you know, whether you recite the long mandala or not, you have the idea of, you know, all these different objects, and you offer that. And the idea is to really think of everything beautiful in the universe. And instead of going, I want, which is our usual reaction to anything beautiful, it becomes, I give, I offer. Yeah. And it's very nice, too, if you can do the inner mandala offering. I find this one very, very helpful because here you imagine taking your body and making it into the mandala. Okay, so your skin becomes the flat base. And the fluids in your body, your blood especially, become the oceans. And your torso is Mount Meru in the center. The four continents are your four limbs, your hands and legs and your two feet. And the eight subcontinents are your upper and lower, you know, of each limb. And then the eyes, the sun and moon. And your ears are the parasol and victory banner. Yeah, your torso is Mount Meru, so there's lots of space for a huge stomach in there. Okay, your head is the palace, Indra's palace on top of Mount Meru. And then all your internal organs are all these beautiful offerings all around. So I really like that meditation personally because I find that it helps me deconstruct my body and practice giving away my body so that I'm not so attached to my body. And that's very, very helpful, you know, because attachment to our body makes us so miserable. And especially at the time of death, you know, clinging on to this bag of filth, you know, what's the sense of that? So it's much nicer to take it and transform it into this beautiful thing and give it and offer it, yeah? Okay, so that's the fifth of the six preparatory practices. And the sixth one is to make requests to the lineage gurus for inspiration by reciting the requesting prayers. Okay, and I think, did he say in here? Yes, he was saying, complete the six kinds of conduct up to the request that the three great purposes of self, others, and both shall be fulfilled. So that request of the three great purposes, that it can be one of the verses that you recite when you're making requests to the lineage gurus at the time of the sixth preparatory practice. So sometimes in the blue prayer book, that's when we say precious and, whenever I have to recite precious. Put in my head, yeah. Precious and holy root guru is in the crown of my head. You know that one? Okay. And then the eyes through whom the vast scriptures have seen that verse. Okay, so you can recite those as requesting prayers. Or actually, there's also a whole huge long prayer to the Lamrim teachers. Or you can also do this one. And this one is found in the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path by Jay Rinpoche, under the section of, when he's describing the preparatory sections, under the part about requesting to the lineage. So let me read this prayer. It's quite nice. Please inspire all my mother sentient beings and myself, so that we may quickly abandon all flawed states of mind, beginning with not respecting the spiritual mentor and ending with grasping signs of true existence of the two kinds of self. Please inspire us so that we may easily generate all flawless states of mind, beginning with respecting the spiritual mentor and ending with knowing the reality of selflessness. Please bless us to quell all inner and outer obstacles. Okay? So it's a very nice one. So what you're doing there is requesting, that all of our misconceptions about all the long-run teachings, beginning with meditating on the spiritual mentor and going through the realization of emptiness, that all the obscurations to realizing those be cleared, that all the realizations and knowledge about these come, and that all outer and inner obstacles are eliminated. So outer obstacles could be, people bugging you and not letting you meditate. Inner obstacles are getting sick or having your mind be in a bad mood or like that. Okay? Okay, so those are the six preparatory practices. So those are what we do. Let's bring it back here to the text. Okay, so those six, yeah, so sweeping the room and setting up the altar, making offerings, sitting in the proper position, taking refuge, breathing meditation, taking refuge, generating your meditation, then visualizing the merit field. It's the fourth one. The fifth one is making offering the seventh in prayer and the mandala offering, and then the sixth one is request to the lineage, and to including your own spiritual mentor. So that is what is included when we're talking about the actual session and the preparation part of the actual session. Okay, so that's also what he's talking about in that paragraph there. Okay, when he says we should decorate the place representations of the three jewels, offer mandala, and complete the six kinds of conduct up to the request that the three great purposes shall be fulfilled. Okay? So we did two paragraphs. Okay? We have time for a couple of questions? Yeah.
So in regards to morning practice, where we're doing specific deity practices, how do the six preliminaries, as far as some of the sadhanas have the four measurables, the seven limb prayer, the
one
offering, some of them don't, and where is the refuge, generating the refuge field in relationship to the deity that you're visualizing, usually in the sadhana? Did
okay.
You follow that before?
Okay, so if you're doing a sadhana practice, you'll find that most of the sadhanas have this built right in. There's refuge in bodhicitta, there's seven limbs, there's mandala offering, and there's some kind of request. Like the Chenrezig sadhana has it like that, boom, 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 boom. Okay, Vajrasattva doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, you have refuge and bodhicitta at the beginning. And if you're doing a deity sadhana, you can, when you're taking refuge, you can either visualize the Buddha as the central figure, or you can visualize the deity. That particular deity is the central figure. Even if the deity practice doesn't have the seven limbs, if you want to add it, there's no fault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? You know, Vajrasattva is not going to say, hey, you know, what are you doing that for? You shouldn't be creating all this merit and doing all this purification. You know, I don't think Vajrasattva is going to object. Okay? She can add things in if you want to. Uh-huh.
Is there a significance to putting Vajradhara behind the Buddha in that visualization of the refuge?
Oh, yeah, sometimes they say when you do the refuge visualization that Vajradhara is on the throne that's behind the Buddha. In that case, that's where all the tantric lineages would be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because Vajradhara is seen as he's the manifestation that the Buddha appeared in when giving the tantric teachings. No, you could have, I think, the other classes of tantra as well. Okay.
May the spiritual teacher to lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all other inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Iram Guru Adna Mandala Kamiryataya.
To this merit may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tending gets of mercy, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arise.